I'm Rain Pryor. I'm an actress. I'm a comedian. I'm an author. I'm a mom primarily, and I love it. I love being a mom, and I'm single for anybody out there interested or not. I'm picky, and you're listening to Rabbi Saul Solomon, Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, everyone. Shalom, my friends. Shalom, my enemies. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I want everyone to arise and shine. No, not like in a Viagra Cialis way. Arise and shine, because we have the hostess of Arise and Shine, a TV show on Arise TV, which I've never heard of, but it's kind of a schwatzer thing. But also, this woman that we're going to be talking to, she's a stand-up comedian, she is a singer, she is a host, she is a performer. You may remember her playing the character of TJ on Head of the Class. And she also wrote this autobiography called Jokes My Father Never Taught Me, which doesn't make much sense unless you realize that her dad was one of the legendary comedians of all time, Richard Pryor. We're talking to Rain Pryor, and I hope you're all going to see her, by the way. And when she does her one-woman show, Fried Chicken and Latkes, I love that title, playing at the National Black Theater, June 2nd through the 28th uptown. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the neighborhood, Rain Pryor. Shalom, Rain.
Shabbat shalom. No, shalom.
Yes, Shabbat shalom to you too. I know it's Saturday morning.
No, it's right in my head. It sure is.
Well, you've been working on this show for a few years now, Fried Chicken and Latkes, right?
Now look, it started 15 years ago as just a straight cabaret show, threw some characters in it, and over the years it's developed to what it now is, which is the gear is to get it Broadway ready. And so now it's on its next real incarnation as a world premiere.
Now, I seem to remember that maybe a year or two ago, you were doing some performances in Midtown. I think it was at the St. Luke's Theater, which is a strange place for a half-Jewish girl to be playing, but...
Well, I did it at the Actors' Temple.
Actors' Temple, oh! Yes,
there
yes.
You have it.
So what has changed about the show? What have you learned from doing the gig there that you're now going to incorporate in its new incarnation as its technical world premiere at the National Black Theater?
One, an audience. Two, that's the big thing. I'll actually have an audience. I have the budget to be able to assemble a set, so it's not just me and a band and a bunch of black boxes. You know, I'll actually have wardrobe, things, and content. As the world has evolved since the last 2 years, some of the content has changed.
I kind of assumed, maybe I was wrong, that this was basically about your life and also the fact that you grew up as the daughter of Richard Pryor. Is there also other stuff, other stand-up basic things? Or
There is. I mean, look, my show is comedy. It's a musical comedy.
Ooh.
Basically what it is. So it's a musical comedy and drama, and I play about 12 to 13 different characters from my life. But really what the show is about, even though I talk about growing up black and Jewish during a stereotypical time, it really is a mirror reflection on what's going on today in society as well.
So do you talk about all the police and the shootings and all of that?
I do a little bit. I do at the end. Like, I have my commentary at the end about the state of the world and how we have sort of, instead of going forwards, we have gone backwards. And it's our responsibility to kind of, if we want something new and different, to change it ourselves. And being a mom, how it's my responsibility as a parent to make sure my child grows up in a world that's full of humanity. But it really is a mirror reflection. I mean, everything I talk about in the show is literally going on today.
Well, yeah, and it probably, unfortunately, will go on 50 years from now. I mean, it's going to be.
Right. But, you know, but I'm one of those people, like, you know, I have a lot of hope. I'm an optimist. I think I'm just a habitual optimist, though I believe the world can change if we choose it to be so.
Is it putting words in your mouth to say that you had an unhappy childhood?
Not at all. Not at all. I actually had a balance. You have your unhappy moments, and then you have your really good moments. I had very solid parents. I mean.
Wait a minute. No, you did not.
I did. In terms of, like, was it typical for everybody else? Like, I don't think there's such thing as normal, by the way. So I think that exists. So for me, my normal made me a strong, independent, focused woman where I chose not to be the stereotype of someone who's famous, who did drugs or whatever, and go down that route. I chose a different path, and I think that says a lot about how I was raised. Things were put in front of me that I don't think in other households are put in front of them, but I chose differently in my life. So I think it's possible.
Well, you chose well, certainly, and you chose to avoid what was probably very, very easily coming to you with a rich, famous father and in that kind of whole insane lifestyle.
Well, look, and besides that, my grandfather on my mom's side, my maternal grandfather, was Danny Kaye's manager for 35 years. I grew up literally in Hollywood, in old Hollywood.
Oh, I did not realize that.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet Danny Kaye?
I did.
He's
great sushi chef, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes, wow. He was. Yeah.
Now, again, the stories about him range from being a really humanitarian and charitable and really sweet to being a kind of a jerk. What did you say,
Danny Kaye? I didn't know him as a jerk. I knew him as the humanitarian. My grandfather was very involved with UNICEF. Yeah. You know, I knew him as a humanitarian, the guy who once made me sushi, you know.
Wow, sushi from the hands of Danny Kaye. So who else did you meet when you were old enough to appreciate who you were meeting?
Dustin Hoffman, Chino, Robert De Niro.
Okay, now instead of just raggling off the names, though, let's have some little anecdotes. And they don't have to be bad or mean.
Listen, I met Robert De Niro and I stuttered because I was so nervous meeting him. And his manager hit my arm and said, "Robert De Niro." Because I literally was like, I was so nervous meeting this man. Dustin Hoffman was just normal, sweet, nice, kind.
Oh, good. Okay.
So that was easy. Chaka Khan always called my dad's house, so her and I would have conversations. She would ask me how school was.
Chaka Khan. Wow. Who else?
I met Eddie Murphy when I was younger. When he was young, he was just brand new in the scene, just came out with Raw. And I was like, I ran around my dad's house screaming his name. So my dad was like, "Shut up, you're embarrassing me," you know. So.
Okay. Well, did your dad worry about new up-and-coming comedians who might be stealing his thunder or seeing as the new guard while they're pushing out the old? Or he didn't have that kind of jealousy?
No, he didn't have that kind of ego.
Really?
He didn't have that kind of ego. If anywhere his ego stood was with women. Like, he thought he was the Mac Daddy of them all, you know. But other than that, that was it.
We're making light of it in a certain way, but he was abusive on some level.
You know what? He was abusive. He was Ray Rice before it was on video. You know what I mean? Like, he was that guy. And I have to say, growing up in that household, I saw all kinds of things. It was the one thing about my dad that I did not like, I did not honor about him. But there came a point even in his life where he said, "I don't want to be that man anymore," and it stopped.
Well, he also had MS at that point. He couldn't hang anybody if he wanted to.
He also made amends to these people, and whether they forgave him or not, you know, that's up to him. But I say to my show, there was a difference between white women and black women in the prior household. The white women took the beatings and the cash, and the black women were like, no, I'll cut your dick off. So,
wow. Simple. Did he ever hit you? And I don't mean in a normal daddy way, like, sweat.
Yeah, and then he stopped when I was 13. He was like, "I don't want to, you know, you're 13, I'm not going to."
Well, once you're 13, you can hit him back. But there was never, see, the one ugliest story, and we'll get all the ugly stuff out of the way first, and then we'll talk about the funny, haha, other things in your life and in your show and your music. But there's apparently a story in your autobiography, and this staggers me, that you were sexually assaulted, not by your dad.
No.
No, but his reaction to it is one of the most awful things I've ever heard.
What reaction?
Oh, maybe I misread this from the Amazon
that's
reviews.
That's absurd.
Well, no, you were, I don't know if you want to use the word raped or sexually assaulted. I didn't read the book. And then you come home and he smacked you for it.
No, that must not have been my book.
Oh, thank God. Okay. No,
that's someone else's book. My dad would never do that.
You were being like too trampy and you brought it on yourself.
No, never.
Okay, somebody wrote that about the book. Oh, good. I'm so glad that did not happen.
No.
Okay.
No.
But you were, so how did he react when you were?
He was very upset by it.
Good. Okay, good.
Very upset, yeah, as any parent should be.
Right, okay. I don't know why that person wrote that particular reaction.
I wouldn't know what that's about, other than I was humiliated when my dad decided to take his own life and set himself on fire, and the school teacher said, well, it's on the news, so it must be true. I was told my dad was a burnt piece of shit and went to the principal's office, and that's what I was told. Well, it's on the news, so it must be true.
Now, wait a minute. It wasn't suicide. He was freebasing and...
He was trying to kill himself. He wasn't just freebasing. My dad was trying to kill himself.
I didn't even know that part.
Side attempt.
Well, how do you know that that was his intent?
Because he told me that, and my dad never lied to us.
Why did he want to kill him? This was before he had MS. Why did he want to kill himself?
There were many, many factors. One, he lost his grandmother who raised him, so he was devastated over that loss. He never kind of gained back his self-esteem. His relationships in his life weren't going well, and he just felt like, why should I be here? Why should I do this? He wasn't a fan of the Hollywood mechanism, although it gave him lots of money. He wasn't a fan of it. He knew how treacherous it was and how repulsive people can be in it, and he just kind of just didn't want to be a part of that anymore. He was done.
Well, he could have just retired, you know?
That's
not how his brain worked. But the thing is, if he was so happy he was so honest with his family, but if he was so honest, how come in the concert movies, he talks about, yeah, of course he turns it into funny, but he says it was just about a drug thing that went wrong. Why wasn't he honest there?
He was honest about it. I think he was, even in interviews, he was honest about it. But I think he talked about milk and cookies and all that kind of thing and freebasing, and that's the comedy and the humor of it. But he talked about the pain in his life. You know, and so I think he was actually honest.
Okay. And then he basically started to turn his life around, and then came the disease, and you were helping to care for him during the last few years, right?
The best that I could have, yeah.
How much of him was still him towards the later part of it?
I would say somewhere in there was him, but it was difficult, and, you know, MS is a very manipulating disease. Not everyone gets it the same. It hits everybody differently. There's different stages and progressions of it. He had the worst primary progressive, where it was rapidly progressive, and I believe that was because he wasn't given all the MS medications that he should have been given at the time that he really needed them. And so that's that.
See, I blame feminism, because everything was fine. We had MR and MRS. And then in the 1970s, suddenly they bring in MS. All these women called MS. And it's just ruined everything, I think. We are talking with Rain Pryor about her dad, of course, Richard Pryor, and his illness that he had towards the end. And that has affected you in the sense of you spend some of your time and energy in helping, well, not just a charitable way, but in a physical way, people who have MS and other kinds of problems, right?
Yeah, I did. I did it for several years, over 15 years, and occasionally I'll go and I'll speak to caregivers and families and with MS and talk about my experience and how important it is to support the research to find a cure and to figure this insidious kind of insipid slow disease out. You know, and now more children than not are getting affected with it. So I really am one, being a mother of a child, you know, it's something that I look at and that's near and dear to me, as with other social issues in the world. So, you know, I'm just an activist, period. So it doesn't matter. You know, I'm going to fight for a cause that touches me, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And
so,
I believe it can change lives.
Now, I want to ask two things about learning curves, as it were. The learning curve of, like, having cared for your dad for a couple of years. What do you wish you had known when you first started caring for him that you learned? And I'm not talking about just medicine. I'm talking about physically dealing with someone.
I think that what I do share as when I speak is that you can take a break. You can take a break. You're allowed to say, you know what, I'm going to take a few weeks off, and you can hand it over to someone else so you can rejuvenate yourself. I think a lot of people get into the martyr mode, which is, I got to be there all the time, and if I'm not, then I feel guilty. And I think it's very important to have self-care, because you can't give more than you're able, you know, to give out if you're not receiving anything. And I think you need to take breaks and rejuvenate your mind, your body, and your spirit to deal with someone who has a terminal illness like that.
I think that is a wonderful idea. As a matter of fact, I'm going to take like a 3-week break from this interview.
I think you should.
Can I put you on hold? And I'll no, just
tease. Back in 3 weeks, yeah. See ya.
Bye-bye. Shalom. Now, my other learning curve question, though, is about comedy. What have you learned over the years, either from your dad or really just from your doing it, that you wish you'd known when you first started doing stand-up?
That comedy is subjective.
Okay.
Subjective. There's no there really is no formula to comedy. There's so many different brands and ways to perform it, to do it, to speak to it, and not every audience is receiving, not every audience is not receiving, you know, so it's subjective that you just have to do it because you have something you want to say and to speak your truth.
Well, yeah, of course, absolutely, as far as speaking the truth. What would you say is your current favorite bit of the piece that you're doing, a fried chicken and latkes? Either thing you personally find funniest or most meaningful?
You know what? I don't know. That's a good question. I like fried chicken and latkes.
I like them too, but I'm talking about your show.
I like very much the piece and what it says, so I'm kind of into it. I don't know if I have a favorite or not. I don't know.
Okay. Just asking. It says, you know, and for some people it would change every night or every performance.
Right.
Let me ask, you were on the TV sitcom Head of the Class when you were still fairly young. What was that like? Do you have any anecdotes or stories about having a sitcom back in the day?
You know what? It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. I created the character that was on the show, TJ. I went to an audition. I performed a monologue. They said, come back, bring a teenager. I came back the next day after reading the LA Times, actually, and I heard about girls that were in gangs, and so I created this character that rapped, and I walked in and performed, and they said, we would like to use her on the show with you doing it. And then I sat with a writer, and we created TJ, and there you have it. And I was only supposed to do literally a couple of episodes, and it turned out to be a 3-year stint for me, and it was awesome.
Yeah, mazel.
You know, like, that's the magic. Like, that never happens, you know?
Well, that's the thing. When Head of the Class, you had such a positive, great experience with that. Did you think then your career would flow that easily from then on? Like, you'd go to another sitcom
I think I was kind of jaded in that way, that I thought that's how it was supposed to go and supposed to be. And I learned right away because, you know, I come from the old school side of business. Like, my grandfather did contracts on a handshake. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden came in this new school where, like, people don't do that. They don't shake your hand and make a deal. They kind of shake your hand, stab you in the back, and you kind of learn by mistakes. And I really learned, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from that experience and thereafter about how to manage a career. I didn't know it was it's really a business. I did it because I love it, not because I wanted a business out of it. And now that I'm older, I'm 45, almost 46, it's a business. There's a way to do things and how to proceed in things. And I feel I'm just now, after many, many years, you know, and maybe because I'm a mother now, it's like I've learned that, it's a business. It's not just for fun.
Now, you, as you say, you are a mom, mazel tov, and it took you, I don't know if Wiki is right about this too, but it took you many tries to have a kid. You really, really wanted to be a mother. Why?
It's in me. I'm a natural nurturer. I've always been that way. I'm just a natural nurturer. And so for me, the next evolution of life was to finally give up of myself and my ego and to put it into raising and developing another human being to exist in the world. And so I think so far so good. I mean, she's 7, she's alive, she's breathing, she's
okay, good. That's a start. She's alive, she's breathing, 5 fingers, you know, on each hand, 10 toes, all that still, thank God, good.
Yeah, Baruch Hashem, right?
But here's the question, though. If you're trying to build yourself up as a live stage performer and a comedian, those people, they've got a tour. They've got to go all over the country, coast to coast. How do you do that while raising a little girl?
Because I make choices. You know, that's the one thing I will tell you. My family comes first, so I make choices of when I decide to tour, when I'm going to do gigs, which mainly for me have always been on the weekends. So I'm home usually during the week. This is the first time I've actually been away for more than 2 weeks from home. And even in my contract, I have it that I go home 2 days a week from New York back to Baltimore so I can at least see her face and have FaceTime. But we also FaceTime, we also Skype, you know, and she's seven and she gets, this is what mommy does. Why? Because it provides her with a life. It allows her to go to school. It allows her to have the clothes that she's wearing, the food that she eats, you know, the play stuff that she wants to do. And when it's her free time, she's, you know, we've always been together. I mean, that's just how it is. She's my kid.
Well, actually,
they give her up to have a career. It doesn't have to be that way.
Well, no, certainly not. But you're playing through the end of June at the National Black Theater in, what is it, 120...
Harlem.
Yeah, in Harlem. I'm Jewish, I can actually say that word now. 30 years ago, I'd be terrified even to say Harlem, let alone...
Well, that's a shame.
Go in a neighborhood. You know, you're half Jewish, so one leg can be in Harlem and the other leg of yours has to stay below 150...
No, I'm human, I can go wherever the fuck I want.
But in a, it is, why couldn't your daughter join you in New York for 2 or 3 weeks if school was over?
She will, she probably...
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
So who looks, you're not married at this point. Do you have your family looking after your daughter? Who's with her?
We have a beautiful co-parenting situation. So husband looks after her, and his family lives in Baltimore, so they're part of our caregiving system. And I have a nanny, and she's part of the caregiving system, and it works out splendidly for her.
It's like a village raising a child, which is, you know.
It absolutely is.
Cool. Now, can I ask, you're single, you're kind of in the looking mode?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, what are you looking for?
What do I look for?
Yeah.
A man.
Okay. This is good. All right.
Yeah, breathing, pulse, you know, preferably has a job and a career. Not a job. I like people who kind of have a career. You know, somebody who's stable, who likes kids. Maybe they have kids, you know. I realize I'm very picky because I have no patience. I'm at that age. I don't have patience for BS. Like, it just doesn't work anymore. The games don't work. It's like, great, okay, see ya. You know, and obviously, you know, I'm not very good at dating at all. I mean, last guy, I dated two guys recently. One guy, you know, was a 54-year-old homeless man, and the next guy, which I did not know.
Wait, how did you meet him? Did you see somebody in a box on 48th Street?
No. Well, yeah, because I liked the box. I was like, oh, it's so romantic in there.
Well, he had drawn cartoons on the cardboard.
And I thought that he had a pet roach. I thought that was cute. and then the next guy worked for, like, the Veteran Affairs Office, but I think he took the affairs part too seriously.
Whoopsie.
And so...
I gotcha.
Yeah. I was just like, okay, well, this isn't going to work for me.
No, because you're an attractive, very talented, and driven person. So I imagine you meet a lot of people, and a lot of people would be interested in you.
I do, but I don't go out a lot. I'm not one of those. Like, I'm very old-fashioned. I think I was born in the wrong era sometimes.
Hmm.
You know, I still believe in courtship. And all that.
Courtship, wow.
I do. And I'm just like, if someone doesn't get it, I'm like, gotta go.
Well, is that a rebellious thing in you? I mean, you saw your parents and your father, obviously, having a very different kind of marital and
my grandparents did it. My grandparents were married for 67 years.
Oh.
And even till the day, you know, it was time for him to go, there was love. He brought my grandmother gifts and flowers for no reason whatsoever. He wrote her little notes. They were playful and cuddly with one another. And so I believe that exists.
I hope it still does, and it still can. So, and maybe while you're doing the show at the theater, you know.
And I let my daughter pick, too, because if she doesn't like you, you got to go. And because my daughter is really smart, I think she's a great judge of character, you know. And so, and because she's the most important thing in my life, she has to be a part of the situation. I don't date just to date. Like, I don't need that in my life. So, you know, there's a family involved in it.
Yeah.
You know, and my ex-husband's very involved, so it has to be someone who's not jealous and you know, insecure about themselves.
Well, how come, how come things didn't work out in your first marriage? Was it just because you were young?
Well, because of what I do. I'm a performer, and I think ultimately what works better for him is to have someone who will stay, not just stay at home, but be in Baltimore. It's like there's no going outside of the box. And also, he became a police officer. And so I think that lifestyle is very, very rigid. There's no flexibility. And I wasn't about to stop what my destiny is supposed to be because he decided you know, to, instead of being a nurse, which was the plan, to become a officer of the law. So.
Was, is he, I mean, it actually does matter. He's in Baltimore. Is he a white cop or a black cop?
He's a black cop in Baltimore.
Oh, okay. Wow, okay. So at least he won't be shooting at himself. This is good.
You know, it's the same. It's tough.
And absolutely. Now, speaking of tough, and speaking again of the racial issue, there's a story that I don't know if this is in the show or not, but or actually, it's someone who came to your show. There's someone who kind of bullied you when you were much, much younger. You were a kid, and called you the N word.
Yes.
I've been called the N word, but it's Nudnik. Very different.
Or Nebbish.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. What a charming lady you are. So this guy called you that word. And
yes.
He ends up, years later, going to your show. Tell.
You know, it was great. He came to the show and he asked. He said, was that me? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, I'm really sorry that you had to sit with that for all these years and carry that. And, you know, and it was great. It's just like, that's you know, what it's about.
Well, it is. But that is a loaded word. And actually, your dad, I mean, two of his albums.
I'll tell you the truth. What makes it loaded is the belief that someone is actually that. And that's what makes it loaded. When you realize, if you can look at your life and yourself and go, I am not that, I'll never be that, it can no longer affect you. But the thing is, we're so driven in today's society by labels and words that they do. They literally hurt us. But it's historically why the word hurts us. And when we can actually face a very degrading history and really look at it, not just say, oh, and mention it in a movie like 12 Years a Slave, but we really analyze what it is and who we are, people that are here really without an identity, mm-hmm. Then we can kind of start to begin to release a word that no longer serves us anymore.
Fair enough.
And
but
it hurts.
When rappers use it or when your
father
uses it.
You know, it's like you. At the beginning, you said Schwarza, and I wanted to reach through the phone and, like, choke you.
Because of not the word itself, but the backstory of the word.
Right.
Although the word, you know, let's face it, the word Schwarz is black. You know this, you're half Jewish.
Of course.
You know that it's a German Yiddish word.
Well, my great-grandfather said it in a derogatory manner, because that's the other word that European Jews use to describe blacks, or even Israelis to describe Ethiopians. So
they'll use the
Schwarz word.
Right.
Either way.
So, it is a kind of a derogatory word. It's not as bad, per se, as the N-word.
You can say that, but that's just, you're the person saying it. But to a person who is black, to me, it's the same as the N-word.
Is it? Well, wow. Wow, okay. I'll have to think of another word. I don't know what other word I can use.
You shouldn't use it at all. How about that? Boom. Right?
No, but that's the thing. People are people, and they get angry, and they want to use an epithet. They want to use
that, and they do, and it's hurtful because they want to hurt you. That's the whole power of words in the first place.
Of course,
like you know, it's the world that we live in today. You know what I mean? Everything's quick, quick, fast. We can shoot things out of our mouths. We're no one is really held accountable. If you look at today's society, no one is held accountable for their behaviors or their actions, and.
Well, wait, that would not be necessarily. They have to go and make an official apology. You know, they're hounded.
Well, yeah, but that's not really being held accountable just because you make an official apology. You have to change your behavior and your psyche about it. I can say I'm sorry for stepping on your toe, but then I could go down the street and step on someone else's toe that doesn't make the media.
Hmm. Fair.
You know?
True.
So, yeah. Right, Rabbi?
This is true. So let me ask you, by the way, I'm kind of curious. You're a mom, you have a daughter, as we said.
Yes.
Is she Jewish? Is she raised? Does she have a religion at all? How are you raising her?
Well, first of all, yes, I'm half Jewish. It's part of my culture. It's part of my history.
Which makes her daughter Jewish.
I celebrate. Hold on, yes.
Yeah.
Makes her Jewish. I celebrate the holiday. She considers herself Jewish. However, my spiritual religious belief is that of Ifa, which is ancient African spirituality and tradition, which is also honoring our ancestors and has some similarities, I would say, in terms of Judaism a long time ago. But that's my practice with her. And for her, I said she can choose to be whatever it is she desires to be as she grows older and she develops her own beliefs and thoughts, but I do teach her the traditions. I do teach her the foods. we celebrate Passover in our home.
Yes! Yes.
Celebrate Hanukkah, you know, and Christmas and all the other...
Well, no, you shouldn't be Christmas. No, Ifa shouldn't have anything to do with Christ or Christians. It's just African culture, no?
No, but her dad, you know, her dad and his family. So, you know, we celebrate it all, you know. but...
I don't know. I have a little problem with bringing Jesus into the whole mix there. Everything else I'm fine with. But you can't have... There's apples and oranges
to me. Look, the bottom line is, no matter what, he was a Jew.
This is true. And look what they did to him.
But they say. Right, exactly.
Now, let me ask you. We're talking, by the way, with Rain Pryor, the actress, the singer, the comedian, who is doing fried chicken and latkes at the National Black Theater all through the month of June. Please go see her and find out more about her at rainpryor.com. It's rain like the seasonal wet thing that we've had here in Colorado for
That's a Queen's rain, right?
Month. And Pryor, not like a prior engagement, but Pryor like her dad, Richard. Speaking of Richard and other people, what comedians have you met, have you had funny stories with, have you learned from, either from his age, his generation, or from yours?
You know, I think the comedians that I've actually learned from are who I admire, or, you know, your Rick Overtons, your Paul Provenzas, your Louis C.K.,
okay,
Robert Klein, Chris Rock, you know.
Have you met most of these people? Have you?
Yes.
Okay.
All of the above.
Any nice stories? Any not so nice stories about any of them?
I would say all of them were pleasant and wonderful.
Oh, good.
And supportive, and Colin Quinn supportive.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you meet any of the legends, though, of your father's time? Well, Robert Klein, obviously, but.
At Steve Martin, I met Robin Williams. You know, I used to play pinball, his pinball machine at his home, with, you know, so as a kid, I've.
Was Robin Williams always? Was he always on in company in your presence? Was did the switch ever go off that you saw?
No, not that I saw.
And so what, how did you feel about him?
I felt he was lovely. He was a lovely human being, and he was always kind to my mother Shelley, and always kind to my dad. And you know, I had a lot of respect for him as an actor and as a performer, period.
Okay, I was just, you know, if there was ever, you kind of wanted to penetrate that wall and say, okay, just turn it off for a minute. Just be you. You don't have to be you on stage, you know, 24/7. But I guess when he wasn't, that was,
right.
I guess he knew what he was doing. Actually, we had a year or so ago in the neighborhood, the daughter of George Carlin.
Oh, Kelly, yeah.
Kelly Carlin, yes. She's doing a show about her dad.
Yeah, she's one of my best friends. She's amazing.
Oh, no kidding. So do you have any George Carlin memories or stories?
I personally don't remember ever meeting George, so meeting Kelly is a whole different situation, and she's a beautiful, smart, intelligent woman, and she's like my big sister, so I love her to death, and I've seen Carlin Home Companion, and I think it's beautiful, and so I'm happy for her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, we talked about the N-word and the S-word, Chata, that you don't like also, but now we come to the big one for the moment, the C-word. Ooh. And no, it's not what you're thinking.
Comedy?
No, Cosby.
Cosby. Oh, well, yeah.
Well, did you meet him? Were you awake?
I was awake. I wasn't drugged. I met him once, and, you know, that's his karma. He has to work out, you know. And do I believe those stories to be true? Yes, I do, but, well, you know.
But you don't know for certain.
Huh?
You don't know for certain.
I do know for certain. I do, from people who were there, who experienced what they're talking about, but, you know.
Oh, okay, so you know the people who are telling some of these terrible things about him, and you believe them?
No, I know some that haven't come out because they choose not to, so I believe them more than I believe the people who came out.
How can there be so many? I mean, it's in the dozens now. How is that?
It really? I mean, come on. Priests have been doing it for years, so, you know.
All right.
It's like, ooh, Cosby's a new thing? Come on.
Bill Cosby is one of the greatest comedians that has ever been. Are people afraid to say now, to separate the man from the fact that he's an incredible genius comedian and incredibly influential? Were people afraid to say, you know, those few albums that he first did on Warner Brothers, Magic, Still, or is everything tainted?
I don't know. I don't know if it means the craft is tainted. I don't think the craft is tainted. The man is tainted, but not the craft.
Okay.
I mean, does Ray Rice become less of a football player because he beat the shit out of his wife? No.
Or Michael Vick with the dogs. But I don't root for him. I root against him. You know?
Right. You might not like him anymore, and that's okay. You have a right to that, you know? So I think that a lot of art comes from pain. It's a way that people survive. So do we poo-poo it? No, we can't really poo-poo it. We liked it then. We can't all of a sudden turn around and go, nah, you know what? I really didn't like it.
Actually, if I eat my bran, I poo-poo it once a day. And I'm very proud of that.
That's nice. That's good. That's
very, very...
Thanks for sharing. TMI, TMI.
Now, also, again, getting back to your dad, there's a story, and I have to check everything with you now because I can't believe necessarily what I'm reading on Amazon and Wikipedia, but you objected...
I never believe what you read on Wikipedia, by the way.
Well, it's 90-something percent.
Your dad.
Correct.
I don't know. You know, I learned that in college. You never go to Wikipedia for your answers.
Oh, you can't. No. Absolutely not. Not for a paper. You have to double and triple check.
Yeah, exactly.
It's but this is not college. This is just my stupid little radio thing. So, question though, what the hell was my question now? Did you object to a biopic that they wanted to make about your papa?
Did I object to it? Of course.
Okay, then why?
Because it's not a true tale or story. It's someone's fabricated, imaginative exploration of what they wished it would be and their denial of really what it was. And so, no, I'm not in favor of it. I don't support it. None of the children do, and that's just that.
Well, did you read the script, or are you just objecting in general? I mean,
I read part of the script, and I've seen some of the audition tapes of some of the people who have auditioned for it, and I think it's horrendous.
But what are they doing that's so wrong or mistaken?
Anyway, moving on.
No, are they still going ahead with it without your blessing?
I don't care.
Oh, okay. Well, what about making your own? Have you thought about making a documentary about ..
I don't know. You know, it's been done so many times. There's been, my dad did it with JoJo Dancer, then there was one on Showtime, blah, blah, blah. It's like, how many more biopics do you need of this man? It's like, enough already.
Okay, that's fair. And one day maybe there'll be a biopic about you.
Hey, you never know.
You know, fried chicken and latkes too or something like that.
I actually have a documentary that is out called That Daughter's Crazy that's making the festival circuits and already has won a couple of awards. And
Now, did you do the film or the film was just done about
I did the film, no.
Oh, That Daughter's Crazy, which is, of course, a riff on one of your father's album
titles. Exactly.
Very cool. And is it on Netflix yet or is it still just on the festival?
Oh, it's just in the festival circuit right now. Yeah.
Cool.
And so that's been a lot of fun, and we're getting ready to go. And in August, we'll be at the Martha Vineyard International Film Festival, showing it there. It's all good.
Nice. Oh, we can push that, too. And then keep that information on rainpryor.com for people who want to follow your career and where you're playing and what you're doing, because you're doing all these different kinds of things. Do you have a favorite bit that your father did from all his comedy stuff?
That's the problem. I have many. I actually do one in my show, though. So if people want to come and see what that is, they should come to the show.
You mentioned it. You talk about it in
a little bit in it, yeah.
Oh, boy.
So, it was amazing. And the thing is, he created Performer. He knew that's what I was going to do. I was never pushed to become a scientist, although I'm very good at that stuff, too, which I think is funny. But I was never pushed to be a scientist or a lawyer or a doctor. I was pushed to be a performer. And so I'm living out what I was made to do on the earth. And so that's what I do. And it's because of him, and it's because of my mother and my family.
Well, actually, we haven't really talked about your mom, because obviously the elephant in the room.
Well, she doesn't like to be talked about, first off. My mom's a very private individual and person. She's a scientist, and she lives her life as that. She's an astronomer, and she's intelligent, brilliant woman, and she doesn't share Pryor as her last name. She's very independent and quiet, and so I respect that.
Again, forgive me for not having read your book, but she was difficult, too, when you were growing up. It wasn't just him. She was...
Right. She was very much present and in my life as well, and at the time, she was also a performer. You know, my mom was a dancer on Shindig and CBS, and also did stand-up for a while, and traveled and was a professional still photographer and, shot all over the place. And then decided she was brilliant and smarter than most people, because she is. She's a genius. And
oh, wow.
Now she's an astronomer, and she's won awards from NASA, and yeah.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah.
I think it's really great the way her life has worked out, considering your beginnings and what you had to
do. Well, exactly. But I think that's life, isn't it? We have choices. You make choices. You either go with the flow, become a statistic, or you choose not to be.
I do want to clear up one other wiki thing, because they mentioned that you were, not so long ago apparently, you were helping run, or the artistic director of, a theater company in Baltimore, the Strand Theater Company,
yes.
Kind of a black
yes.
theater thing. And yet when I went looking for their website, you're not mentioned at all. Did that stop, or are you still there, or what?
No. I stopped. The great thing is I got them to a level where they can afford to do whatever it is that they want to do. But the theater is there, but the theater company that I was, helped to raise money for fell apart after I left.
Oh.
And it was a great opportunity, and I produced some great stuff. They got great reviews there, and directed shows as well. They got great reviews in the Metro Washington and Baltimore area. Yeah, and that was it. Like, I ran my course because my show opened on... off-Broadway, so I had
to... Oh, and yeah, you had to go and do, of course.
You know, you do what you make money at. I'm doing that. I'm not making money.
Yeah, no, this is off you're in the National Black Theater doing a month of off-Broadway, off-Broadway contract. It's not Richard Pryor money, let's say.
But it's equity money, so it's good.
Oh, that's true.
But, yeah.
Guaranteed for 4 weeks. Now, let me ask, though, after June, obviously you want to bring the show to Broadway.
After June, I'm part of the National Black Theater Festival in North Carolina. I'm
Ooh.
There with my show, The Hopes Yes, to take it to the next level, to Broadway or whatever. I really don't care at this point. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. I'm doing it because I love to do it.
Of course.
And I was given this beautiful opportunity to work with amazing producers at the National Black Theater in Harlem.
Sure.
And also to have amazing director, Camilla Forbes, who is the assistant director for Raisin in the Sun on Broadway.
Oh.
And so I have a team of amazing people behind me right now, and I play it out to whatever it needs to be played, and then I go off and do other things. I'm one of those people, like, I never stop. My
right.
team constantly is working and writing and creating, so, you know, I have other plays that I've written that I'm not even in, so I might produce those afterwards. I you know, it's whatever, but...
that's why I'm kind of wondering, like, what other irons are in the fire? Are you directing anything? You said you've written these other plays. Are you going to be performing as a singer somewhere? Or is all your focus, at least for the next few weeks, on Fried Chicken and Latkes?
My next focus is on Fried Chicken and Latkes, and then after that, it's my documentary, because it's the Martha Vineyard,
right.
You know, International Film Festival. Then in September, I'm in London having the London premiere of That Daughter's Crazy there. And then October, a horror movie I did called The Night Watchman is coming out, and I have a part in that, and that should be out in October, right before Halloween, so that's great and wonderful, woo! And,
So, see, if you want to keep tabs on all these amazing things that Rain Pryor is doing, remember, it's rainpryor.com, and of course, everybody, go buy tickets. It's playing as we speak at the National Black Theater up in Harlem. Rain Pryor, it's been delightful and fun.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Solomon.
Oh, thank you, and shalom to you.
Shalom. Peace.